Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Bahar Azmi of the Center for Constitutional Rights, who discusses efforts to gain the release of detainees being held at the Guantanamo U.S. Detention Center, who continue to be imprisoned without charge or trial. Former Israeli and Palestinian fighters, members of the group Combatants for Peace, who comment on an Israeli government panel which recently declared that West Bank settlements do not violate international law. And Marge Baker of the group People for the American Way, who discusses the Senate Republicans' defeat of the Disclose Act, blocking a grassroots drive for more transparency in U.S. elections. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Conflict resurfaced in the mineral-rich Democratic Republic of the Congo as rebel troops loyal to renegade General Bosco Ntaganda overtook several towns on the Uganda border and threatened Goma, a key city for mineral traders bordering Rwanda. General Ntaganda is wanted by the International Criminal Court for war crimes. The outbreak of fighting by the M23 rebels forced over 220,000 people to flee their homes and seek humanitarian aid. The conflict also halted mineral exports from the region, including tin, cobalt, and other metals used in computers, cell phones, and consumer electronics. Renewed violence in the region has delayed the launching of several conflict-free mines in eastern Congo, certifying that minerals did not come from mines controlled by warlords or rebel groups. The Dodd-Frank banking law requires American firms to scrutinize their supply chains to ensure companies are not profiting from atrocities in conflict zones. A UN panel of experts claims the M23 rebels are backed by the Rwandan government. Ethnic conflict in the eastern Congo dates back to the 1994 genocide of the Tutsi ethnic minority at the hands of the Hutu majority in Rwanda. Goma became a center for refugees, including soldiers involved in massacres. BBC correspondent Andrew Harding maintains that the current conflict in the Congo is about control of minerals. Harding laments, "The civilian population, on the move in large numbers, is paying the heaviest price for the monstrously casual violence meted out by various armed groups still vying for control over the mineral-rich east of the country." In mid-July, the Obama White House raised concerns about the movement of Syria's large arsenal of chemical weapons, which had been built in the 1980s with the aid of the Soviet Union. Arms control officials say that Syria's undeclared arsenal includes stockpiles of sarin, mustard gas, and cyanide. In addition, Western security analysts say Syria has the ability to fire Scud missiles filled with chemical agents against its foes, including neighboring Israel. However, Syria denies their chemical weapons are being moved and has questioned why, if U.S. intelligence is so good, why has Washington never attempted to stop the flow of weapons into the country and end the anti-government uprising, which has claimed an estimated 17,000 lives over the past 16 months? The Wall Street Journal reports that U.S. officials are split about Syria's motives. Some believe that Syrian President Bashar al-Assad may use chemical agents against rebels challenging his government, while others contend Syria is attempting to secure its arsenal in the face of growing political instability. Western arms control experts have long feared that Syria's stockpile of chemical weapons could fall into the hands of Hezbollah in Jordan or a faction of al-Qaeda militants. Syria, along with seven other nations, including Israel and Egypt, has not signed the 1997 Chemical Weapons Convention that prevents the watchdog agency from inspecting or safeguarding Syria's chemical weapons installations. Florida insurance adjuster Mike Partain discovered he had breast cancer at age 39 and underwent a full mastectomy followed by months of chemotherapy. He quickly traced his disease to Camp Lejeune, North Carolina, where he was born when his father, a Marine first lieutenant, was stationed at the base. In the late 1990s, North Carolina TV stations reported on toxic contamination at Camp Lejeune. From the 1950s to the mid-1980s, over 750,000 people drank, swam, and bathed in water contaminated with industrial chemicals. Solvents like PCE, perchloroethylene, and TCE, trichloroethylene, were found in drinking water wells. According to Mother Jones magazine, Camp Lejeune has the most contaminated drinking water supply ever detected in the United States. Partain quickly found that other men with Camp Lejeune ties also had breast cancer. His cancer registry has identified 77 cases of male breast cancer linked to the base. Partain and retired Marine Jerry Ensminger blame the Pentagon for moving too slowly to close the contaminated water wells and for failing to completely disclose the extent of toxic contamination. Thus far, over 2,100 Lejeune veterans have filed medical claims for illnesses like non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, kidney, and bladder cancer. The Veterans Administration has only taken responsibility for treating 25% of the cases. An agreement is pending in Congress that would force the VA to cover the medical costs of all Lejeune victims. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Liz Becker.
On July 10th, the U.S. released Ibrahim Ahmed Cosi, who had been held since 2002 at the nation's Guantanamo Detention Center in Cuba. Cosi, a native of Sudan, was convicted by a 2010 military tribunal of providing support to al-Qaeda's now-deceased leader, Osama bin Laden, as a driver, cook, and bookkeeper. Although nearly 800 men have been imprisoned at Guantanamo since the camp opened in January 2002, only 7 have received trials for their alleged crimes. Of the 168 men who remain prisoners at Guantanamo, 87 have never been charged with a crime or received a trial. The Obama administration's own review task force, the Pentagon, intelligence and law enforcement agencies, conducted a review of the status of Guantanamo prisoners in 2009 and concluded that these 87 detainees posed no danger to the U.S., yet these prisoners remain in legal limbo. Although President Obama pledged to close Guantanamo during his 2008 presidential campaign and signed an executive order to do so shortly after taking office, the detention camp appears to be very far away from closing its doors. Part of the problem lies with Congress, which used its spending authority to withhold funds that prevented the White House from transferring Guantanamo detainees to the U.S. to stand trial in civilian courts or move these prisoners to an Illinois state penitentiary to be held indefinitely. Your reporter spoke with Bahar Azmi, legal director with the Center for Constitutional Rights, who discusses efforts to gain the release of detainees being held at Guantanamo who continue to be indefinitely imprisoned without charge or trial.
There are currently 168 detainees in Guantanamo, and surprisingly, I think probably most people don't know that the past 18 months in Guantanamo has seen the fewest number of releases or repatriations basically in the history of Guantanamo. That's in part because Congress has restricted the president's ability to return individuals to their home country to try people on U.S. soil. But it's also in part based on the timidity of the Obama administration and their unwillingness to genuinely push back against Congress and effectuate the kinds of releases and transfers from Guantanamo that are necessary to close the prison. And the Cosi piece is interesting because he's actually pled guilty to a war crime, and it's not sure those charges are valid. But it's worth remembering that of the 168 remaining detainees, 87 have been cleared for release by the Obama administration's Guantanamo Task Force. What does that mean? All of the relevant agencies that supervise Guantanamo, Defense Department, State Department, CIA, the Director of National Intelligence, unanimously concluded that these 87 should be transferred from Guantanamo because they pose no current threat to the United States or our allies. Yet those 87 remain, and it's utterly unconscionable that the jailer would continue to imprison individuals the jailer itself thinks don't belong there.
Bahar, what is it that your organization, the Center for Constitutional Rights, is doing right now to try and change the current situation so that these detainees will no longer be in legal limbo?
Well, it's particularly challenging these days because the original promise of the Supreme Court's 2008 decision in the Boumediene versus Bush case has been largely forsaken by the lower courts. So that largely means that the courts are not really a viable option in the way that we thought it would be, and has forced us to think about other advocacy and political mechanisms. We've brought a historic case in an international tribunal, the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights, in which we will challenge the legality of certain policies in Guantanamo. We're attempting to put pressure on the U.S. government to repatriate a bulk of detainees who are cleared for release to Yemen. We're trying to work with other countries to encourage them to accept detainees for resettlement and hope to solicit others, your listeners and other progressives in this country, to hold the president to his promise to close Guantanamo down, particularly in an election year, and not to take his base for granted.
Well, just finally, Bahar Azmi, Americans generally like to take pride in their country as a democracy, upholding the rights of defendants in our court system. But obviously, since 9/11, a lot of the thinking about the rights of those detained, guilty or innocent or unknown, has gone out the window. And I'm wondering, do you see any trend lines that give you hope that we'll get back to a system that's respected here and around the world in terms of having a judicial system that actually works on behalf of everyone, not just those who are in favor politically at the moment? Obviously, people suspected of terrorism are not in favor, and as we see in Guantanamo, they are now suffering the consequences.
I think you've identified the problem, which is that we have constructed an alternate system of justice for Muslims and Arabs. And these rules, whether in Guantanamo or I think prosecutions in the U.S. criminal justice system, are reserved primarily for this other entity of Muslims and Arabs, despite the relative security in this country in the past several years. I don't currently see any signs of hope among the political branches, but I do continue to see lots of people who remain engaged and outraged by this practice. And I think ultimately what's going to have to happen to end it will have to happen in the same way it's happened with other social movements, which is that Muslims in this country need to stand up and become more political and voice their objections and build coalitions with other like-minded individuals to say that these kinds of practices have to stop.
That was Bahar Azmi, legal director of the Center for Constitutional Rights. For more information about the international campaign to close the U.S. Guantanamo Detention Center in Cuba, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Combatants for Peace is an organization made up of former Israeli soldiers and former Palestinian fighters who have concluded that violence will not lead to a just and peaceful settlement in the Middle East. They condemn Israel's occupation of Palestinian lands and support a two-state solution based in part on Israeli withdrawal from the West Bank. Combatants for Peace members often travel to speak in the U.S., always in pairs. On July 15th, Israeli Erez Crispin and Palestinian Noor Shahada joined more than 200 local residents in New Haven, Connecticut's third annual iWage Peace Walk, organized by local billboard company owner, peace activist and filmmaker Bruce Barrett. The walk calls on all people of goodwill, especially Christians, Jews, and Muslims, to work for peace in Israel-Palestine. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Crispin and Shahada after the peace walk. She began by asking their opinions on the recent report by an Israeli government-appointed panel known as the Levy Committee that stated, contrary to international law, settlements in the West Bank are legal, affirming Israel's long-held position. The report also concluded that most unauthorized outposts, up to now considered illegal by the Israeli government, should also be officially recognized. Israeli Erez Crispin responded first.
It's the Levy Committee, which was appointed by the government, the Israeli government, and decided what the government of Israel, the current right-wing government of Israel, wanted to hear and decide. But this is a political committee. It wasn't a judicial committee. The settlements are illegal. Any settlement is illegal according to the international law. It is the number one obstacle for peace and for settlement with the Palestinians. They are located, the settlements are located in a way that you cannot create a Palestinian state, a contiguous Palestinian state. And that's our message, that the United States finally has to object the industry of settlement and be active, implicitly and actively, against this problem for peace.
Noor, as a Palestinian, what do you think of this development?
This land, all the people in the world agree in 1967, is Palestinian land. How we can take a decision to illegal building in this land? It's not Israeli land. How we can take decision for not your land? This is a problem. I think this is put a lot of big stones in the way of the peace. It's make a triple of the peace. I am not agree this decision. I hope the Israeli government we can take a decision to serve peace, to do peace, to make peace, not make a decision to be war, to be new intifada.
Do you think that that decision could lead to another intifada by Palestinians if they feel like it just is dashing any hope of a settlement where Palestine could have an actual functioning country, a two-state solution?
I can't tell you, but it's reason because the settlement we will eat all the Palestinian land in 1967. The settlement, it's expanded in Palestine. It's very, very big problem. It's the first problem now to make peace, to build a state in Palestinian land. Where is the state when the settlement is expanded more than this? Where is the Palestinian state?
I just read today that in accordance with the settlement from the hunger strike, the Palestinian prisoners, that they've started allowing some of the Gaza prisoners from Gaza to have family visits, but there's a lot of restrictions. You know, do you see that as a positive development?
There are certain laws, international laws, regarding how can you treat prisoners and detainees. And Israel currently doesn't give all that it needs to give in terms of rights to these prisoners. There is a good step forward in recent weeks, resulting probably due to negotiation between the Israeli government and Hamas. I hope that it continues and they will give them the rights that they deserve as detainees, as prisoners, and I hope that they will release most of them, because most of them are in prison without trial, and some of them deserve to be in jail, most of them not.
There's been talk about getting Hamas together with Fatah and some kind of a unity government, which has been not the case since 2006 or 7. Do you think that would help lead to a two-state solution between Palestine and Israel if the Palestinian factions get together, or do you think that isn't where the Palestinians need to go? Noor?
Hamas, it's one of the faction in Palestine. The people from Hamas is the Palestinian people. It's no differences between people from Hamas and people from Fatah, all the people fighting to be a freedom. I think when Hamas and Fatah we make an agreement, it's give a lot of power for the peace. It's give big chance to do a peace. We need to go to the non-violent struggle. This is the important thing for me.
Erez, as an Israeli, what do you think?
I think that there is a window of opportunity now. Hamas is on the fence from several reasons. We can attract them. We can give them all the reasons to support the two-state solution, to support the existence of Israel, or we can distract them. We can give them all the reasons to return to the path of violence. I think that it's not only the Fatah, it's also up to the Israeli government to decide if they want negotiations with Hamas, because there will be negotiations, the same way that there weren't negotiations with Fatah, and at some point the Israeli government decided, realized that it's better to attract these factions and to talk to them. I hope that the same decision will be made regarding Hamas.
That was Israeli Erez Crispin and Palestinian Noor Shahada, members of the group Combatants for Peace. Find more information about Combatants for Peace and other organizations working for Middle East peace on our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Over recent decades, the U.S. has witnessed a steady and steep increase in the millions of dollars spent in congressional and presidential election campaigns. But after the Supreme Court's January 2010 ruling in the Citizens United versus Federal Election Commission case, the rate of spending has risen exponentially. In its 5-4 decision, the High Court ruled that corporations and unions may give unlimited and anonymous donations to elect or defeat political candidates. In their decision, the justices declared that corporations have the same rights as living persons. Since the Citizens United decision, corporations and wealthy donors have established dozens of so-called independent political committees and super PACs, where unlimited and unaccountable funds can be funneled into political campaigns so long as their activities are not coordinated with the candidate. In a pattern established during this year's GOP primary campaign season, a handful of super wealthy individuals have stepped up to virtually single-handedly bankroll their preferred candidates. One high-profile example is billionaire casino owner Sheldon Adelson, who recently pledged $10 million to the oil billionaire Koch brothers' goal of spending $400 million to defeat President Obama and the Democrats in this year's election. An effort to circumvent one element of the Citizens United decision went down to defeat in the U.S. Senate on July 16th, when Republicans blocked debate on the Disclose Act, legislation that would require nonprofit political PACs to disclose the names of donors who contributed $10,000 or more. Your reporter spoke with Marge Baker, Vice President for Policy and Program Planning with the group People for the American Way, who discusses the significance of the Disclose Act's defeat and the national movement that's being organized to challenge unaccountable money in politics and overturn the Citizens United decision.
What the court did in the Citizens United decision in 2010 is it really overturned, 100 years of settled law and held for the first time that corporations could dig into their deep-pocketed treasuries and spend unlimited amounts to influence our elections. The court also in that decision presumed that Congress would be able to enact laws that would require the disclosure of where that money is coming from, who is actually making the contributions. In fact, the court in that decision by an 8-1 majority said that disclosure requirements were constitutional. So what we're seeing today in the Congress, there was a straight party line vote. We actually really didn't get to a vote on the merits of the bill because the Republicans are filibustering the bill, won't even let Congress get to a debate on the merits of this measure. And what the disclosure bill would do is really simple. It's just sort of a transparency accountability measure. And it would say any organization, whether it's a corporation, union, super PAC, nonprofit, has to report within 24 hours of making an election expenditure of $10,000 or more. And donors to those organizations that give $10,000 or more would be made public unless the donors says that their contribution cannot be allowed for election spending. So it's a simple, straightforward disclosure measure, permitting the public to know who's behind all the spending that we're seeing manifest itself in this negative ads that are just consuming our airwaves.
Marge, I know some Republican opponents of the Disclose Act make the case that they feel that imposing a disclosure on donors, large donors, over $10,000, would have a chilling effect on political giving, subjecting those donors to quote-unquote intimidation. How do you respond to that charge that disclosing folks who are contributing enormous amounts of money to political campaigns would open them up to intimidation?
Well, it seems that the essence of our democracy is transparency. The essence of our democracy is to understand who the messengers are and be able to debate that openly. But if you don't know who's behind the massive amount of spending, then it's hard to unpack what the message is, how to debate the message. So that so-called dark money really undermines the the fundamental theory of an informed and an educated electorate. And while the sources of the dark money are not open to the public and therefore can't be kind of debated openly, you can be sure that the candidates on whom that money, for, on whose behalf that money is being spent, know who's spending the money on their behalf. So it's, I think, really corrupting of a free and open debate not to know what the source of the money is. And if someone can't stand by the positions that their money is being used to advocate for, then I really question whether or not we have that kind of open and transparent public debate in our public forum that we really need to have to make democracy work.
Now, what happens next? The Republicans have seemingly effectively blocked the Disclose Act. Is there any possibility that could be resurrected, realizing that that in itself won't overturn some of the more disturbing ramifications of the Citizens United decision? It just enables people to find out who is spending this money. It doesn't disallow the money from being spent.
Well, I think there's a couple of things. One, with respect to the Disclose Act, there's been a vote, and senators are on record. And we know who voted, and we know it was on straight party line votes. And some of those senators are up for election. So I think it's totally, you know, legitimate to hold the senators accountable for the votes they took to continue this, perpetuate the dark money that's really endangering our democracy. My organization also, in addition to measures like Disclose, which will mitigate the effects of Citizens United, is pressing two other really important points. One is that understanding that when people go to the polls and they vote for the president, they're voting for someone who is going to nominate justices to sit to take these lifetime seats on the Supreme Court. And so understanding that who you vote for president will affect who may fill the next vacancy that occurs on the court is something that's also very important to keep in mind. And the third avenue that we're pursuing is ultimately a constitutional amendment, the way to undo the decision separate from changing who sits on the court is through amending the Constitution to overturn the decision. And we are actively engaged in that with a number of allies. And there is growing momentum and understanding that, that ultimately that's what is going to be necessary in order to restore our democracy.
That was Marge Baker, Vice President for Policy and Program Planning with People for the American Way. Learn more about the movement to overturn the Supreme Court Citizens United decision by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hale and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Liz Becker, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.